to give the Spikies a taste of boot leather. Apparently they tried to kill the big boss with shadows or something, and he weren't pleased.
Snaggy tried to imagine that. Uftak Blackhawk was unyielding was perhaps the best term, in that the git just wouldn't let go of something once he'd set his mind to it. Snaggy was used to orcs being either obsessive and narrow-sighted on a particular area of focus, like some of the pain boys and mechs he'd encountered, or easily distracted by something flashy. Black Orc gave off the disconcerting impression of actual long-term thinking, and definitely the notion that he might hold a grudge. If the Spikies had gone and properly riled him up, rather than just being the obvious target for the orc's incessant need to fight something, this was not going to end quickly.
So anyway, since the portal opened right after the disorderlies nicked that Spiky we found, we figured that what you said was right,
Swipe said quietly.
That's how to open the portal. So we're with you, boss. You obviously know what's what.
Yeah,
Gip said, with the slightly uncertain expression of a grot who'd cynically thrown his lot in expecting a bit of rank, and found to his surprise that there might be something underneath to believe in after all.
I guess the gods do speak to you. Well, yeah,
Snaggy muttered through his throbbing head.
Course they do. I ain't gonna lie to you. So what now?
Nib asked, his voice betraying his nervousness.
Are we gonna make a break for it? A daring escape? Nah,
Snaggy said quietly, eyeing up their surroundings.
We're smack in the middle of the war, with a couple of runt herds behind us. We ain't going anywhere except through that portal. We can't take these things slow,
he added, to their disappointed expressions.
Orcs are about as bright as a dead glow squig, but they're going to realise something's up if we try to leg it here and now, and they'll just clobber us, since we lost the Spiky.
He added with deliberate emphasis.
We're going to have to go along with them for now, then get away when they're concentrating on duffing up the Spiky's mates. Find another one that's nearly dead and try the same thing again. This time without legging it and leaving me to get clogged in the zogging head, maybe.
He finished with more than a little venom. He looked around him again. All of his original audience were here, each one of them hurrying along in a desperate bid to avoid the attentions of the runt herds, but they were swallowed up in a much larger mass of grots. Runt herds tended to herd all their charges together, regardless of origin. Orcs were part of distinct mobs and took their orders from a particular knob, but grots were just grots and no one cared. As a result, it took Snaggy a few more seconds of furtive searching before his eyes lighted on the distinctive truncated nose he was looking for.
Back in a minute, lads,
he announced to his immediate followers, and dropped back into the crowd. He was jostled and shoved, but he jostled and shoved back until he managed to position himself just behind and to the side of his target.
Gecky Short Nose,
he announced, in the same tone of voice that one might use to pronounce the doom of an entire dynasty. Gecky jumped and nearly fell over his own feet as they continued hurrying forwards.
What do you want?
The other grot demanded once he gathered himself. Snaggy could tell that Gecky wanted to square up to him, but he was too scared of the runt herds, so he kept trotting forwards, and Snaggy kept trotting just behind him.
I thought you was going to find a Spiky and you did to get us out of here,
Gecky continued, accusingly, looking back over his shoulder.
I was,
Snaggy agreed.
Ran into a bit of trouble. Doc Drosfang's disorderly showed up and nicked the git from us, and I can't help but wonder how they knew where to find us. Well,
Gecky said, after Snaggy had left a meaningful pause.
I don't know. No,
Snaggy said.
You didn't like me, Gecky Shortnose. You didn't believe me. You didn't trust me. I reckon you were scared that I might be right,
he added, deliberately raising the volume of his voice, not enough for the runt herds behind to hear him, but definitely so that other nearby grots could.
I reckon you went and found the disorderlies and told them what we were up to and which way we'd gone in order to mess me plans up.
That's ridiculous,
Geki protested.
I wasn't even watching.
There's one thing you're forgetting,
Snaggy told him.
The gods speak to me, Geki Shortnose, and they told me what you did.
He had his stabber out before the other grot realised what was about to happen and sliced it across Geki's scrawny neck. Geki coughed and bubbled as blood began to flow, stumbled, fell, and was immediately tramped on by the grots following behind.
Oi!
A runt herd bellowed, angered more by the disruption than the death, because who cared if a grot died? Who cared if 20, 50, 100 grots died? Not the runt herds. Snaggy scuttled away through the massive grots around him as one of the big gits came lumbering forward, then settled down into the same half-panicked rhythm as his fellows. The runt herd, failing to find an obvious culprit for the commotion, contented himself with laying about with his grot lash a couple of times on general principle, then fell back to survey the group from the rear again.
What did you do?
Swipe hissed in horror from Snaggy's left.
The git betrayed us,
Snaggy said, shoving his still bloody stabber back into its sheath.
He got what was coming to him. Are you sure it was him?
Nib asked.
Of course I'm sure,
Snaggy snapped.
The gods told me.
And if that wasn't completely true, if he hadn't had the same green-tinged visions he'd had in the past, if he hadn't heard the same booming voices that were part explosion, part Dakka and part engine roar, with their words that were individually unintelligible but still capable of a generalised sense of what the deities were getting at, well, so what? Snaggy was a prophet of Gork and Molk, and it was surely just downright lazy to expect the gods to do all the hard work on that front. They couldn't be expected to make every little decision for him. So he would do what he knew was best, safe in the knowledge that he had their favour. After all, if he was doing something really wrong, they could always tell him so, couldn't they?
Just remember, lads,
he said, as the shimmering portal loomed up in front of them.
There's only one thing worse than an orc, and that's a traitor.
The expressions of the other grots around him were a mixture of awe, belief, and fear. Snaggy grinned. He might currently be being herded along by orcs with whips and beasts who would happily feed him into the teeth of the enemy without a second thought, but right at this moment, he also had power. And that was a start. Chapter 16. Uftak had to admit he was impressed. The spiky, strange bubble city was still too dark, too weird, and extremely pointy. But it was also big, and an orc could respect size. With very few exceptions, the biggest orc would be in charge. Bigger guns were shootier. The reason Gargants were so big was because it was the closest an orc could come to a visualisation of their gods, and their gods were, essentially, really big orcs. The Spikey's bubble city wasn't as big as a planet, at least this part wasn't, but it somehow felt bigger, because it was obviously not a natural thing. Planets were planets. Uftak didn't really think about them, other than watching and cheering from orbit when a fleet's big guns started giving whoever was down there a proper headache prior to the lads dropping in and letting them have it up close, which did not mean that the big guns would stop shooting. Many an orc's fun had been ended by an over-enthusiastic and under-aimed barrage from their own ships. Planets were supposed to be big. They wouldn't work otherwise. Someone or something had built this place, and it was bigger than any other made thing Uftak had ever seen. There was no orc war machine that would look impressive in these surroundings, not even a ship. Uftak knew that because far, far above, the tiny shapes of spiky ships were just visible.
We ain't in space,
Uftak said to the boffin, peering through the make-bigger lenses the mech boy had given him. They brought the sharp, angular vessels into larger and clearer focus, and he could somehow tell, despite the distance and lack of obvious scale, that these were full-sized void ships, rather than more of the little skimmers they'd seen so far.
How are they staying up there?
Probably some sort of gravity, Govins,
the boffin opined, taking the make-biggers back and looking again.
The gits seem to like that sort of thing, floating about everywhere like the ground's too good for them.
Says you,
Uftak said, looking meaningfully down at the boffin's current method of propulsion.
Yeah, but this just makes stairs easier,
the boffin said, slightly defensively.
The wheel was sogging annoying for that. Ain't like the battle wagons have got to worry about stairs, so I ain't looking to make any of them float just to show off.
He sucked his teeth thoughtfully and looked through the lenses again.
So, Buzz, what's the plan?
Stomp the gits,
Uftak said. As if to put the emphasis on his words, something else exploded as a stomper's super rocket detonated like a tiny sun. A chain reaction of secondary explosions followed, each one a ball of crackling dark energy shot through with veins of white lightning, and a spire some distance from the original explosion began to crack and fall.
Sort of got that,
the boffin said.
I meant after. Let's say you stomp all the gits in here, teach him a lesson for sending hungry shadows after you and everything. What happens next? Are we staying here and fighting whoever shows up after that?
Suppose we'd probably better get back to the rest of the war,
Uftak admitted.
The Mech Lord wouldn't be calling us all together unless he'd got a big old fight planned, and we don't want to miss out on it.
In truth, he was chafing at the idea of being summoned like a grot that hadn't done a task, and he still hadn't found anything particularly fancy he could show off like the Mech Lord would be expecting. On the other hand, he was already tiring of this place. Not the fighting. That was good fun and he had a grudge to settle. But the actual place. Impressively large, though it was dingy and dull, and Uftak's orcish mind was rebelling against it. The whole point of orcs was to be loud and colourful and extremely violent, and these surroundings were the anathema of that. They were old and dark and monochrome, and sound didn't quite carry properly. They were already partially ruined, so even the most enjoyable bit of destruction still felt a little as though you were just hastening a process that was going to occur anyway.
So, we're going to need to get out of here at some point,
the boffin said.
Yeah, reckon so,
Uftak said.
Guess we can just go back the way we came, get back to that planet we was on. Don't feel quite right, though.
I know what you mean,
the boffin said, nodding.
Orcs ain't meant for going backwards.
Trouble is, we don't know what other gates are going to get us anywhere,
Uftak continued.
Could grab a spiky and twist bits off it until it told us, I guess, but I ain't sure the gits wouldn't enjoy it.
He frowned as a thought occurred to him.
On the other hand, give me those back a minute.
The boffin handed the make-biggers over, and Uftak put them to his eyes again. He scanned quickly across the shadowy vista laid out in front of him, but there was as yet no sign of any massive counter-offensive from the spikies as the first wave of the war pushed deeper and deeper into this new battleground, so he turned his gaze upwards again.
Those are definitely spiky spaceships, ain't they?
He said.
Yep,
the boffin confirmed.
I've seen the light before several times. Nippy, blurry little gits, but they come apart as soon as you land a proper shot on them. So they're going to need to be able to get into space,
Uftak reasoned. He searched around for a few seconds, then let out a triumphant grunt.
Got it. There's a massive portal up there in the ceiling thing, big enough for a ship to get through. That's got to lead out of this place and into space. And once we're in space, we can go anywhere we want, just like before. Maybe,
the boffin said.
But we ain't got a ship. We ain't got a ship yet,
Uftak corrected him with a grin and pointed upwards.
Reckon you can make one of them go?
Well, it's a bit more complicated, isn't it?
The boffin said.
I mean, there's go, yeah, but there's also stop.
and left and right and up and down. And then there's the really technical stuff like up left and down right and this is a yes or no question.
Uftak cut him off.
Can you fly the socking thing? Yeah, shouldn't be too hard if Spikies can do it,
the boffin said with a sniff.
They might be all fancy and flip around unnecessarily and that, but their machines have got to be pretty simple to control, given how much time they spend running away.
He sucked his teeth again.
Any one of them take your fancy? They're all a bit weedy,
Uftak muttered, which was the honest truth. Ork ships were blocky and solid, even if they were actually the halves of two different ships welded together. If there was an enemy in sight, then you shot them. And if that didn't work, then you rammed them. Simple tactics, but effective ones. And ones which required a robust vessel to carry them out. Spiky ships were as spindly as the beings that made them, and just as prone to snapping in half if you hit them in the spine. On the other hand, a lot of them could still deliver a decent punch. A silhouette caught Uftak's eye, and he refocused the make-biggers, kicking the magnification up as far as it could go. There was something very familiar about that.
Soggin' egg,
he muttered. He had been shot at enough by the Spikey's dark-like guns to recognise their shape and profile by now, and the one he was looking at right at this moment was underslung along the belly of a Spiky void craft, and that made it massive. Uftak tried to imagine the level of damage that thing could kick out, and found that he couldn't smile wide enough to envisage it. Now that was something not only worth having just for the destruction it could cause, but also as a prime candidate for taking back to the Mechlord and showing him that Uftak Blackhawk could come up with the goods.
All right, I know which one I want,
he said, handing back the make-biggers.
The biggest one, with that sogging great gun on the underside. You see it? You're going to be able to get it for me. Don't worry about it, boss,
the boffin said, beaming.
I'll get a bunch of the lads together and we'll get right on it. Nazlug, you're in charge while I'm gone.
Nazlug looked up in surprise, and the other spanners around him backed away from his fire-singed shape uncertainly.
There's got to be a quick way up,
the boffin added, looking around them.
I can't see the Spikies climbing stairs all the way to the top. Don't think they've got the patience for it. That's your problem now,
Uftak told him. He felt a lot more at ease now he had a plan in place for getting back out into the galaxy and receiving the acclaim he was due once he was done here. He unslung the snazhammer from the sticky metal on his back and twirled it, then hopped back onto the rear of his truck.
Mogra, get us to the fighting. You got it, boss,
Mogrot replied happily and mashed the go pedal to the floor. The truck accelerated away, but Uftak's attention was caught by the smallest of details. Just for a second, before a death dread got in the way and blocked his view, he was sure he saw a grot staring at him from out of a crowd of other grots that had just come through the portal. The strange thing was that the grot did not seem to be staring at him in awe or fear or the slack-jawed incomprehension so common to its kind. Instead, its expression was one of undisguised malice. What was even weirder was that although one grot looked a lot like another, Uftak could have sworn that it was that runty git snaggy little tooth. He shrugged and turned away to let the headwind pull his lips back from his teeth. So what? It wasn't as though a grot was important. If you could say one thing for Mogrot Redtooth, it was that he generally used relentless enthusiasm to overcome whatever obstacles he found himself facing as a result of his lack of actual brain power. If you could say a second thing about him, it was that ever since an escapade involving a shock jump dragster, a broken bridge and a Humi Gargant, he got it into his head that any vehicle could fly without issue if you drove it fast enough.
Whoa!
Mogrot bellowed and hauled on the wheel to send the truck careering off the side of the raised roadway on which they'd been driving, directly onto the mass of Spikies below them.
shocking idiot!
Uftak yelled, but there was nothing for it now. The truck was dropping like a yellow and black stone, with only seconds before it hit the ground. He leaped over the side, followed by a happily squealing princess, which appeared to be assuming this was a game, and Nisquik, who was little more intelligent than Mogra under most circumstances, but had a far better developed sense of self-preservation. Uftak only had a moment to size up what was underneath him before he landed on it. He got a brief impression of a bipedal mass of misshapen pallid flesh, bulging with artificial muscle and studded with vials, devices and implants. It looked up at him, its attention caught by the rapidly descending shadow overhead, and he saw a bronzed mask, lined with dark slits which gave no clue as to the appearance of the face beneath, on a head that was disproportionately far too small for the body on which it perched. Then the energised blade of the Snazhammer's axe head smashed into that mask and carved it in two, followed in rapid succession by the thing's head, neck and torso. The monster fell apart in a welter of blood and guts, not even its formidable physique capable of standing up to the Snazhammer when driven down by the twin forces of gravity and Uftak's powerful arms. Uftak had the very briefest sliver of satisfaction just as his boots touched the ground, and then the truck exploded behind him. The powerful jet engines which gave a vehicle that size such immense speed needed a lot of fuel to power them, and it all went up at once. The fireball licked out, carried on the wings of a wave of concussive force so powerful that it smacked Uftak in the back and knocked him onto his face in the messy remains of the thing he'd just killed, while Princess and Nisquik sailed past at what had been his head height. He'd have been in trouble had the force of the blast not flattened all the spikies around him as well and left everyone in the same buffeted and slightly deafened state. All the same, this was no time to be lying around. Uftak pushed himself back up, wiped his hands clean of bloody gunk to grip the Snazhammer properly, and began to swing. The spikies here were strange ones, not like most he'd seen. Your regular spiky was just a pointier scrawny with more hooks and sharp edges, and generally either hidden behind their surprisingly tough armour or moving so fast that the gits barely needed it. These ones actually had some heft to them, looked as though they'd got more than one meal a week, and appeared to have largely disregarded war plate in favour of a few bits of flappy cloth here and there, and some surprisingly form-fitting leg coverings. The sculpted flesh of their torsos was bare, exceptionally bare in some cases, apparently lacking skin altogether, and with the wet grain of muscle exposed to the air. And they pressed forward without bothering to try and dodge or block his blows, as though pain held no fear for them. To be fair, that suited Uftak fine, because he wasn't inflicting pain so much as catastrophic injury. He simply swatted aside the first two that came at him, knocking the first one to the right and the second one to the left with massive impact wounds in their chests, then brought the Snazhammer straight down on the next, crushing it to a pulp. He lashed out again and knocked the head clean off another, reached out and grabbed the neck of a fifth with his free hand, broke it with a twist, and hurled the rapidly dying thing into two more of its fellows. That broke the initial rush. The few remaining creatures fell back into the shadows, gibbering and hooting wetly from behind their featureless metal masks in voices that sounded more animalistic than anything else. Uftak paused for a moment and took a breath.
Mograd, he bellowed without turning around. You dead?
For a moment, there was no reply. Then,
nah, boss, landed on me head. Hey, look, there's a bunch of the lads. Over here, boys. You wrecked me truck. I liked that truck,
Uftak said. He frowned as a new shape appeared in the shadows in front of him. It seemed to have more arms than was usual. Had the spikies teamed up with the bug eyes? Uftak had heard of some unlikely alliances being forged in the crucible of necessity, but he didn't think the bug eyes teamed up with anyone.
Sorry, boss, won't happen again.
The many-armed shape scuttled forward, but it didn't move like a bug-eye. They were all ferocious fluidity, whereas this thing had an insectoid jerkiness to it. It was a spiky, Uftak could see that now. It had too many arms and a long coat, but it was definitely a spiky. He wondered why it was moving so strangely. It was a distraction. The big gits came at him from either side. Two more like the one he killed when he landed, bigger even than him, and far larger than the little ones he'd just slaughtered. Each one lashed out with a massive cleaver as long as many an orc was tall, their breath hissing through the slits in their masks as they put all the power of their grotesquely over-muscled bodies into the coordinated blows. They were coordinated too well, each one striking for his neck. Uftak managed to catch both strikes on the Snazhammer's haft, which, through some miracle of Gorkand or Mork, didn't break, then went on the offensive. These things were swift for their size, but were they the equal of Uftak Blackhawk, big boss of the Tekwar? He swayed away from one blade while punching the head of the Snazhammer into the knee of the other gear, caught the wrist of that one as it staggered, and yanked it across to block its mate's next strike with its back. The massive cleaver hewed into pale flesh and deformed, protruding bone, and Uftak shoved as hard as he could. Both his enemies went staggering, and as the injured one collapsed, it wrenched the blade out of the other one's hand. The one still standing came for him, but it had to step over its mate to do so, which gave Uftak an extra moment to set himself. The big git lashed out at him with the strange device that encased its left hand, but Uftak met the blow coming the other way with the head of the Snazhammer and shattered both device and the hand within, then used the axe head of his weapon to carve his enemy open diagonally. It flopped backwards, flesh and bone separating to expose glistening innards, and Uftak brought the Snazhammer down on the head of its prone companion just in case it got any ideas about getting up again. A sharp sensation in his ribs alerted him to the fact that the forearm spike he had scuttled forward and stabbed him with some very sharp fingers. Uftak didn't even bother with the Snazhammer. He just grabbed it by the head and hoisted it up to eye height while it wailed in pain and thrashed in a futile attempt to escape his grip.
"What's the big idea?" Uftak demanded angrily. "What's that meant to hurt? Who'd you think you're dealing with, my lad?"
He simply squeezed. The spiky skull cracked within a second, and it went limp. Uftak threw it away, then shook his hand a few times to get the brains off and looked around to see what else was going on. What remained of his truck was on fire. Nisquik and Princess had re-emerged from where they'd been thrown by the blast, both moving a bit gingerly. Mogrot, blackened with soot, had clearly found a few enemies of his own to scrag, and was cheerfully approaching with a knot of boys that included the familiar shape of Doc Drosfang.
"Boss," the pain boy said cheerfully as he stomped up.
Uftak could remember when Drosfang had been an imposing figure of saws and pinches and syringes. These days he was just another orc, the top of his head barely reaching Uftak's chin.
"I got me grots to get a spiky what was nearly dead, just in case it would come in handy. But I gave it a shot to perk it up a bit, and the git carked it, ungrateful little toe rag that it was. Want us to grab another one if we can?"
He looked around, and his brow furrowed.
"Of course, you don't tend to leave nothing alive when you fight, so we'd have to go looking somewhere else." "Nah, don't bother," Uftak said. "We can grab one if we need it."
He scratched at his ribs where he'd been stuck.
"These are some right weird kids. Bodies looking all strange and that. Reckon you could learn something from them."
He'd intended it as a joke, since Drosfang had always enjoyed mucking about with body parts, which Uftak wasn't going to complain about, since transplants were a standard procedure for orcs and had saved his own life. But he wasn't prepared for the grimace that crossed the pain boy's face.
"Oh, no thanks, boss. I had a quick look in some of the underground bits we just came past once the spikies fighting us were dead. And by the great green, these lads need their heads looking at." There was one thing I saw what had four faces, and if any of them was the original, then I'm a six-legged squiggog.
He shuddered.
Not even sure Grotznik would like what these kids are up to, and that's an orc who don't take no for an answer when he asks if you want some new legs. I know what you mean,
Uftak said, surprised to find that he actually did.
Seems like anything what should be fun. The spikies find a way to make it weird. Say, boss,
Drosfang said,
you're scratching a lot.
Uftak realised that he was indeed scratching at his ribs yet again.
Yeah, one of the kids got me with his fingers. Didn't hurt, but it's...
He broke off as a sharp pain lanced through his side.
What the soggy neck? Oh, dear.
To Uftak's shock, the doc actually looked worried.
That ain't good. I've seen this before when the spikies have been about. They like poisons, these lads. Poisons?
Uftak thundered, then leaned on the snazhammer as it felt as though someone had dug a chopper into his side.
The bloody cheek of it.
Poison wasn't just cowardly, it was pointless. The whole purpose of a fight was to see how good you were and have a laugh in the process, not to stick someone once and then run off laughing behind your hand until they fell over. How could that count as winning?
Yeah, and the itchy sort is especially nasty,
Drosfang said, rooting through his kit bag.
Makes you start growing.
Uftak looked at him.
Don't sound so bad. Makes you start growing faster and your skin can keep up,
Drosfang elaborated.
Saw it happen to a couple of lads a while back. They ended up just bursting.
Uftak screwed his face up.
That sounds, sort of hilarious, but it ain't exactly the way I want to go out.
He winced again.
Okay, yeah, definitely something wrong in there. Fairly sure things shouldn't be pulsing like that. Got it,
Drosfang exclaimed triumphantly, pulling a syringe out of his bag.
This should do the trick. Hold still, boss.
Uftak eyed him uncertainly. Normally, letting a pain boy inject you with anything was very low down on the list of things a sensible orc was prepared to tolerate. But Uftak was pretty confident that Drosfang was invested in his survival. After all, Drosfang had mainly risen to prominence within the Wa due to his association with Uftak's rising star. As a result, he reluctantly let the pain boy stick him with the needle and depress the plunger, although not without a shudder of misgiving.
Right, now you might feel a bit off for a while,
Drosfang said in a low voice.
But that's only normal, what with the mixture going on inside you. Main thing is you shouldn't burst out of your skin now. That's good.
Uftak nodded, blinking heavily.
That's good.
He frowned and squinted upwards as something caught his attention.
What's that? That's not good,
Drosfang bellowed.
Shoot us out, boys. The sky kids are coming.
Uftak had wondered when they were going to show up. Apart from the few who had attacked when the Wa'a first arrived in Spiky City, there had been precious few of the small, zippy gits, of which you normally got so many in a spiky warband. Now they all seemed to be coming out of the sky at once, blocking out what passed for light in this place. The gits on their flying planks. The gits on the flying single-seater war bikes that went nearly as fast as a fighter bomber. And even the gits that had their own wings. They were banking between the spires, strafing the land-bound orcs beneath them with their weapons. There weren't enough of them to turn the tide of the battle on their own, but they were going to be a zogging nuisance until the boys could muster enough massed firepower to knock them down.
Is it just me?
Mogrot began slowly.
Or are a lot of them heading this way?
Uftak squinted again, trying to focus both his eyes and his brain through what increasingly felt like thick fuzz.
Like a lot,
Mogrot added. He didn't sound worried. That would involve being able to comprehend cause and effect, which was usually beyond him, but he was definitely turning the concept over in his head. In fairness, Uftak thought muzzily, there was a lot of space in which he could do so.
"We can't take them all at once," Drosvang yelled, as the first ragged volleys of shooter fire failed to deal much damage to the incoming horde. "Scatter!" Uftak watched the orcs around him dive in for cover behind wreckage, corpses, and corners of buildings, and wondered what the fuss was about. Even the first spattering hiss of needle fire from the sky gits striking stone and thudding into the flesh of the spikies he'd killed didn't really register as a problem. "Boss," he heard Drosvang yelling desperately, "get over here."
Uftak frowned. Why was the pain boy giving him orders? He began to turn to give Drosvang a piece of his mind, and a series of wickering thumps heralded the arrival of a line of darts in his arm. Uftak looked down at them, wondering how they'd got there. The pain hit a moment later, but only for a moment, because then a new fuzziness, sharper and darker somehow, began to spread through him. He was dimly aware of steely coils lashing around his wrists and ankles, and then the ground began to drop away from him. His last sight was of Princess leaping upwards and latching onto a floaty plank with its teeth, only to be kicked in the snout until it let go and dropped back to the ground with an outraged squeal. And then blackness flooded over him completely and erased all sensation and awareness. Chapter 17.
"We have their chieftain,"
Mikulatik said, the words slipping between his sharp teeth like envenomed blades. The leaders of Port Tavar were in a luxurious suite within the massive edifice that was the arena of the Cult of the Deathly Sorrow, and surrounded by delicacies and delights of all kinds. From the agonized crystalline statues of enemies who had fallen prey to the glass plague, to the artwork depicting various debauched acts, and even the monkey strapped to a rack and subjected to nerve stimuli, simulating the sensation of being slowly roasted alive over an open flame. So Azuli had spared no expense on the decor. Mikulatix's glass was filled with twice-tested pleasure wine, and he was reclining on an artificed couch that moulded itself to his form, but the Master Homunculus was still far from relaxed.
"The initial strike was a success," he said impatiently. "Why are we not cutting the Arrakia to shreds while they are leaderless?"
"You are free to take your forces and do so, of course,"
Zuzuli Mindrek said lazily, nipping a sliver of cured Volanti liver off the spike blade of a long rondel. Dimera presumed the weapon was not coated with toxins, but she would not put it past the succubus to have ingested an appropriate antidote as a matter of course. Witches might delight in the thrill of combat and the spray of arterial blood, but that did not mean they did not find satisfaction in the bloated, discoloured flesh of a poisoning victim.
"You may have forgotten," Mikulatik said crisply, "but the purpose of this alliance was to destroy these vermin. Instead, you have your prize and have retreated again as though you fear them."
Zuzuli raised one perfectly sculpted eyebrow. Her blood brides did not stiffen in response to the insinuation about their mistress's courage, since a witch was always ready to flow into deadly motion, but they definitely bristled. Still, no weapons were drawn, since Zuzuli's followers would not commence violence without her permission. If they had, then Mikulatix's hemoxites would have undoubtedly responded. The Master Homunculus's prized racks would be slower than their opposite numbers, but Dimera could not even begin to guess what obscene flesh grafting and hidden biological enhancements lurked beneath their scarred skins.
"Master Homunculus," Dimera said smoothly, rising to the role of peacemaker since no one else seemed to want to. "The crux of the plan was to let the Arrakia tear themselves apart. Our host managed to spirit her prize away as agreed. The Arrakia advance has stalled, and they are inevitably inflicting casualties upon themselves as the new hopefuls try to secure their status. Should we intervene too soon, we risk them uniting against us once more as the obvious threat.
We can use this time to prepare new defences, ready our own troops and make the smaller cabals, covens and cults fall into line, and be ready to greet the filth with murder as soon as they show any sign of regaining cohesion. And you seized your own captives to have your fun with, did you not? Zuzuli said to Maculitix.
That is hardly the point, Maculitix said loftily. Besides, he added, your facilities here are rudimentary at best.
Our dear master Homunculus is probably just edgy since the Poe was taking bites out of his domains before they were halted,
Zuzuli said lazily. She walked languidly to a table to which a naked Asuriani was strapped and began to carve herself a piece of meat from his thigh. The trapped Eldari was so tightly secured that his attempts to thrash in pain produced almost unnoticeable results, and the puncture marks on his throat showed where his vocal cords had been severed, meaning a breathy hiss was the only disruption to Zuzuli's snacking.
Mmm, she added. Will you not try some? We have administered no sedatives, so his flesh is free of those bitter aftertastes.
My domains contain devices and locations of critical importance to all those with whom I am allied,
Maculitix snapped, waving away the succubus's offer of freshly carved flesh.
It is in no one's interests for them to be overrun by vermin.
Are you saying that you are unable to defend your own halls? Dalgar asked, with what Dimera considered to be a singular lack of diplomacy.
I would have thought you would be particularly keen to see my facilities preserved, given how recently you required them,
Maculitix responded, acidly. His scissor hand snicked open and shut twice, as though he was subconsciously considering removing one of Dalgar's limbs. Dimera hoped he would not, mainly because her cabal's honour would force her to respond in some manner, despite the fact that she would be secretly delighted. Maculitix and Dalgar continued quarrelling, in the low-key, barbed-tongued way of Drukhari, who had no imminent intention of drawing blood. Dimera sighed and crossed to where Zuzuli stood. "I would like to see the captive," she said. Zuzuli looked at her in what appeared to be genuine surprise and swallowed the bloody morsel on which she had been chewing.
"Whatever for? You will see it tonight when the games begin."
That was another reason why Zuzuli was not keen to move immediately against the orcs. The Arena of Deathly Sorrow hosted nightly games that the population of Port Tavar paid great sums to attend, and the cult was not going to miss a show simply because of an invading army. The death and destruction occurring in a different part of the subrealm would be ignored, since to do otherwise would be to admit that there was actually a threat.
"Call it simple curiosity," Dimera said.
In truth, she was not sure why she desired to see the orc, but it was an impulse, and she was Drukhari, so she indulged it.
"By all means," Zuzuli said. "It is being held in one of the dungeons."
She snapped her fingers, and a Mon-Ki slave in the colours of the Cult of Deathly Sorrow stepped forwards, hands folded at the waist and head bowed.
"Take the Master Archon to see the new alien gladiator."
The slave merely bobbed her head. She made no verbal acknowledgement of the order, because to utter "yes, mistress" would be to suggest that there was a possibility of "no, mistress," and turned to lead the way. Dimera caught Sistriel Verne's eye as she made to follow. The Archon of the Falling Night looked over at her inquiringly, and for a moment Dimera had a strange urge to invite her rival to accompany her.
"Can you make sure they don't do anything foolish?" she said instead, flicking her eyes towards the ongoing squabble.
Sistriel's eyes widened slightly in surprise at this demonstration of trust, but then he gave the faintest of wintry smiles and inclined his head briefly in agreement. Still, Dimera felt the other Archon's eyes on her as she exited the chamber and had to fight against the expectation of a knife between the shoulder blades.
Sistriel's words and actions appeared to suggest that their unexpected alliance remained firm for so long as the Orcish menace persisted. But Dimera had picked up on oddities. Lingering glances, and Sistriel positioning himself to always be near Dimera, yet slightly behind her or to the side so he could observe her without her observing him in turn. That suggested there was something else going on. She pushed her doubts to the back of her mind. Whatever her rival's motivations, Dimera was convinced that self-interest would see their alliance hold for now. The last thing either cabal could afford was for hostilities to erupt between them when their forces were already in such close proximity. Such a conflict would be brutal, devastating, and lead not only to Port Tavar being weakened, but also to the bloodied remnants of each cabal surely being swallowed up by untouched rivals. The slave led her down, away from the sweeping vistas of views enjoyed by the suite, and into the arena's windowless bowels. Passing groups of witches gave Dimera hard stares, but nothing more. No matter the temptation of setting themselves against such a lauded noble, Zazuli's underlings knew better than to give insult to their mistress's guest and ally, lest they be the ones strapped to a table with their flesh on offer for the enjoyment of all. Had the slave guiding her been one of Dimera's own, then she would have engaged herself in idle amusement with it, such as tripping it, pulling its hair or otherwise accosting it. Good manners prevented her from doing so to someone else's property, but she did not bother to hide her aggravation at their pace, despite the slave's apparent attempts to hurry. The Mon-Ki were just so slow and cumbersome, unless artificially enhanced in some manner. The warriors known as Space Marines were the most obvious example. Greatly swollen in size and strength, and indeed speed, and encased in their primitive yet durable armour until they posed a credible threat even to Eldari fighters. Thankfully, such specimens were very few in number. The Mon-Ki were a frail race by nature, and most homunculi agreed that they had such specific requirements for gene crafting and flesh smithing that such amusements were best carried out on other species. It was only humanity's dogged perseverance, their half-remembered yet broadly functional technology, their indifference to their own casualties, and their cloying faith in their dead god that made them such a galactic nuisance. And then, at the other extreme, Dimera reflected, there were the Arrakia. Immensely durable, alarmingly and unpredictably innovative, and with an approach to technology which appeared to consist largely of deciding that they were going to achieve the desired result and daring the universe to prove them wrong. Unlike the Mon-Ki, who could be pain-trained with relative ease into complete obedience and to perform moderately complicated tasks, an Orc with any semblance of freedom would try to kill its master without hesitation. Should any Drukhari find a way to control the beasts or bring them into service, their power might even threaten the dominance of Azrael Vect himself. They had reached the dungeon levels now. Wailing and gibbering reached Dimera's ears as they walked down row after row of cells and cages, and she could smell the sweat and fear coming off the slave in front of her. The Mon-Ki's fear of Drukhari was ever present, but repressed, lest it overwhelm and paralyze her, and so cause her to be executed as uselessly disobedient. The creatures around them were a new and different source of terror, however, and the slave had insufficient mental barriers in place to prevent herself from being compromised. Something slammed wetly and heavily against the door of a cell to their right. The slave jumped and gave a small squeak of fear, and Dimera couldn't help herself. "Fear not, child," she said softly, sliding her fingers through the slave's hair and clenching them into a fist at the back of the Mon-Ki's scalp. "I will protect you." The slave went stock still, frozen in place by Dimera's touch and the words that she understood despite the language not being her own. Her eyes, wide and terrified, flicked towards Dimera's face, and the Archon saw two emotions writ large in the dark pupils, yearning for the protection Dimera's words had offered, and fear at the knowledge that she was being toyed with. There was no protection here, and the slave knew it, but that did not stop her from wishing for it with all that remained of her soul. Dimera leaned close and breathed deeply, taking the scent of the slave's terror down into her lungs. Her own soul, ancient and wizened though it was, rejoiced in the suffering of another, and Dimera withdrew with a sigh of contentment. The refreshment was mild and brief, but enjoyable nonetheless. "How much farther?" she demanded, and the slave jumped, then scurried off to lead the way again like a prey animal, realizing that the predator had withdrawn without striking. Dimera followed her, smiling. The slave stopped with another squeak of fear when they rounded a corner and were confronted by a hideous masked form. Dimera did not pause, for she knew the raiment of a beastmaster when she saw it. "You," she snapped, "where is the new Arrakia?" The beastmaster regarded her silently for a moment, his mask unreadable. Then he nodded.
"You must be the Archon I've been hearing about, the new ally. I'm Carfind, the mistress's chief beastmaster. Come, it's right here."
He gestured with his whip to the cage in front of him. Dimera drew level with him and looked inside. Through massive bars nearly as thick as her own waist, and the shimmer of some manner of force field. She drew her breath in sharply and had to force herself not to take a step backwards. "What in the name of all the muses?" The cell was dimly lit, so much so that the slave was unlikely to be able to see anything within. But Dimera's eyes could penetrate the gloom well enough. However, she was struggling to believe them. "The force field does not confer any sort of magnifying effect," she asked, already sure that she knew the answer.
"No,"
the beastmaster said. It was hard to tell with his mask on, but Dimera thought she could sense a sort of stoic amazement emanating from the other Drukhari. The beastmaster knew exactly what he was looking at, but he had no idea how it had come to be. "Then what has happened?" Dimera demanded. "I fought this beast not a day ago."
"We believe it was injected with electrosteroids by a flesh gauntlet," Carfin said. "Normally that would cause massive, uncontrolled muscle growth that would rip its skin open, but it seems to have been given some sort of counter-injection by one of its own kind. Then the sedatives used to put it under in order to bring it here slowed its metabolism, giving the counter-agent time to work. And now..."
He gestured.
"Well, some of the growth has occurred, but as you can see, not how we would have expected."
The dark mass within the cell sat up from where it had been lying on the floor, and Dimera met the gaze of two red eyes in a head the size of her torso. Then the orc heaved itself to its feet, its head going up and up and up. The slave began to whimper, and Dimera caught the acrid scent of urine. The Monkey had lost control of its bladder in its terror. It was an understandable reaction for the weak-minded when faced with this monstrous creature, but it hardened Dimera's will. She had placed her hands on this slave without exacting such a level of terror. How dare this crude beast outdo her? "Thank you for the information, Beastmaster," she said coldly. "I wish to be alone with the creature." Had he been her underling, Dimera could have dismissed him without question. Here, in Zuzuli's realm and speaking to Zuzuli's servant, her authority was less complete. However, Carfind apparently decided that he had no intention of arguing with an Archon, so he slapped his coiled whip across the legs of the slave to make her walk, and moved off down the corridor to leave Dimera facing the orc chieftain on her own. It had been big before, but it was massive now. Its clothing had ripped and torn, and there were gaping spaces between the remaining plates of its armour. It was somewhere between 2 and 3 times her height, easily larger than the biggest grotesque. She looked at its enormous fingers, as thick as her arms, and suppressed a shudder at the thought of them wrapping around her body. The creature could likely crush her to death with one hand, should it be able to catch her.
"Are you capable of speech, beast?" she asked softly.
The orc's ears twitched. Its eyes narrowed, and it took a single seismic step towards the bars of its cage.
"Can you speak?" Dimera said again, but this time she spoke in the Monkey tongue they called Low Gothic.
It was a barbaric, blocky language that stuck between the teeth, but it was widely used and understood by many species across the galaxy, since humanity's xenocidal manifesto did not preclude some of its individual members from trading and negotiating if they thought there was a benefit to be had. The orc took another step. It was now standing right up against the bars. It did not grab them like a prisoner might. It simply ignored them and stared straight at her, as though its incarceration was of no concern.
"Yeah," it said in Low Gothic, its voice a rumble as deep as an earthquake.
Chapter 18. Something had happened involving the Wa, the lads, and some sort of spiky counterattack involving Skygits, but de Boffin was no longer paying attention. Like many odd boys, he was broadly capable of functioning within orcish society. Indeed, his special interests were critical to it, but only for so long as those special interests were not massively overstimulated by a specific discovery or problem. He'd been given a task by Uftak, which was to capture the biggest spiky ship with the massive gun on it, and so that was what he was going to do. This wasn't just a question of loyalty to the big boss. De Boffin hadn't heard of any mech boy capturing and flying a scrawny ship before, of any sort, so this had become a matter of personal pride. He couldn't wait to see what sort of weird gubbins they had on their craft, let alone how he might be able to integrate and override them with his orky know-whats. Of course, he still had to figure out how to get to the Zoggin thing.
"That thing's got to be miles high," said Dregit, one of his spanners, looking at the spire to which the target ship was attached far, far above. "I mean, we could fight our way up it, sure." He nodded vigorously, as though to convince himself of the truth of what he'd just said. "But it's going to take a Zoggin long time. Also, the Spikies will probably realise what we're up to and try and make it difficult for us. Might even move the ship before we get there," de Boffin said, scratching his chin.
"Whoa!"
Dregit's jaw dropped open.
"That's proper cunning. Good job we got you around to think of stuff like that before the Spikies do." "Yeah,"
de Boffin said, absently. He'd amassed a sizeable chunk of lads, not much compared to the full strength of the Wa, but certainly enough to kick a bunch of Spikies off their own ship. But he'd only done so with the promise of a good scrap, so they weren't going to stick around indefinitely. That was the problem with being a mech instead of a big boss. Even in the Tekwa, the Mech Lord was the only mech boy with any real authority. So they needed to get up very high, and they needed to do it fast enough that the Spikies didn't realise what was happening before it, you know, happened. Aircraft? No, that was no good. The Wa didn't have anything which could fly that could transport more than a few lads at a time. What about putting the lads into trucks and having the aircraft fly them up? De Boffin dismissed that idea as soon as it occurred to him, since quite apart from the varying performance of different craft, flyboys were notoriously capricious. They'd be more likely to forget they had something attached to them and try to zip off in different directions to blow things up. What about fixing up some of the Spikies' wrecked vehicles? They could float. De Boffin toyed with the idea for a few seconds, then discarded it. Nicking one of the Gits' thrusters and making himself hover with it was one thing, but trying to get a whole bunch of their sky trucks back into working order, let alone getting orcs of lesser intelligence than himself to pilot them, was something else entirely. They were zippy, wobbly things, and likely to be unforgiving of inexpert handling. He had no idea how many orcs they would carry either, given the weight discrepancy compared to their usual cargo. After all, the things had barely put up any resistance when the Wah's tractor cannons had wrenched them down into the ground.
"That's it," the boffin exclaimed, snapping his fingers. "Dregit, you're thinking about this all wrong."
Dregit blinked.
"I am? We don't got to get up to the ship," the boffin said, warming to his moment of inspiration. "We just got to get the ship down to us. Bring all the tractor cannons up. We'll pull that thing right off the tower it's stuck to and get it down to where we can reach it." "Brilliant, boss," Dregit said happily. "But do you reckon we've got enough cannons? We ain't got any of the real big space hulk catching ones, and that thing might not be a space hulk, but it's still a fair old size."
The boffin sucked his breath in between his teeth in the time-honoured manner of an expert considering his opinion. Then he reached out and clipped Dregit round the back of the skull.
"Oh, what's that for? You're thinking about this all wrong, Dregit," the boffin barked. "We can't just pull the ship down. It's too big. This ain't like a space hulk with proper planetary gravity wells and atmosphere and that. The spikies are messing around with gravity up there, and as soon as we tug the ship outside of it, it's going to fall right on us and squash us flat."
"If you say so, boss,"
Dregit muttered, rubbing his head.
"I do say so," the boffin said. "Now go and get the zogging cannons."
To Dregit's credit, he took a precautionary step away before speaking.
"But, boss, you said we couldn't tractor the ship down to us. You literally said that just now."
"Don't tell me what I said like that somehow makes you the smart one,"
the boffin roared, rounding on his spanner.
"Keep up, Dregit. Of course we can't tractor the ship down here. Any grot could see that. But who says a tractor beam can only work one way?"
Dregit frowned.
I don't know. Who?
"Well, whoever does their wrong," the boffin said irritably. "We ain't gonna tractor the ship down. We're gonna reverse tractor ourselves up."
Chapter 19. A thrill ran through Dimera as the monster spoke. It was a jolt of excitement prompted by the rare sensation of a new experience, since she had never before in her centuries of life conversed with an orc.